On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The excitement of a deep water rig in the Gulf of Mexico this month brought the old Texas oil strike jubilation images to mind. Oil, oil! But in this case, the now-celebrated Jack II well was pulling oil from miles beneath the ocean surface. An extraordinary 5 miles down, the Gulf's deepwater Jack oil field looks like it might be the biggest find since Prudhoe Bay. The deepwater technology is amazing and now racing to deep oil worldwide. Critics of the view that oil supplies are peaking are crowing. Environmentalists are shuddering at the thought of new oceans of global warming crude. Crude oil prices are falling. Up next on Point, from miles beneath the sea, the rush and implications of deep water oil. We'll hear the latest in the peak oil debate and the environmentalist perspective in this hour. But first, we turn to the astonishing feat of the latest deep water oil drilling itself. Earlier this month, Chevron and its partners announced successful production from the 5-mile deep Jack well in the Gulf of Mexico, 175 miles off New Orleans. Paul Sigley is head of Chevron's deep water Gulf exploration. He joins me now from Houston, Texas. Mr. Sigley, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here with you today.
How did you do it, and how significant is it?
Well, it's pretty significant from the standpoint of this is a brand new play. It's called the Lower Tertiary Play. It's older and deeper than the traditional rocks that produce in the Gulf of Mexico, and we didn't know if it would flow at all. So the news of the discovery is somewhat dated, but we'd made the original discovery a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of about a half a dozen or so recent discoveries in the trend, but no one knew if it would flow. So the exciting news is that it's flowing at potentially commercial rates.
For those of us who aren't experts, paint a picture of what's out there in the Gulf at this site. What's it look like, and what, you know, what's the frontier that it's plumbing underneath that rig?
The rocks extend for about 200 miles from where Jack is located south of New Orleans all the way over to the Texas Gulf Coast. They are very deep, as you said in your opener, 5-6 miles beneath the surface of the ocean. So they're technically very difficult to reach. There's only a handful of rigs in the world that can reach those drill depths and drill in those water depths.
What does the rig that's out there at the Jack well look like? Is it the traditional thing we've seen of a, you know, sort of a little rig on the ocean, or is it a ship? What's the facility look like?
It looks like a oil tanker with a big derrick on top of it. It's an immense ship, 500 feet long or so. And it's capable of sleeping about 200 people that work out there. It generates enough electricity to power about a 50,000 or so small city.
And the challenges of bringing up the oil from 5, 6, 7 miles down, how do they compare with traditional, you know, oil drilling at sea?
You know, the water depth is a big challenge. It's out at Jack, it's about 7,000 feet. The trend lies in water depths of, say, 6 to 10,000 feet, so there's a challenge with just the water. Then it's deep drilling besides that, so 25, 30,000 feet of drilling. So there's challenges to extract the oil up, and one of the big ones, as I mentioned, the rocks are older, and we just don't know how fast they'll flow. So that was the good news of the test.
We're told that this may be the biggest find since Prudhoe Bay decades ago, that it could increase U.S. oil reserves by 50%. For companies like Chevron, with this new technology that allows you to go miles down into the earth, under the sea, does this open up a new era, a new frontier globally?
Well, it certainly opens up an important trend in the Gulf of Mexico. And I want to be careful to distinguish the Jack discovery from the trend itself. The trend has got a lot of potential, several undrilled structures, so there's a lot of exploration that still needs to be done here. But, yes, it's an exciting new trend for the United States.
And we're reading about possibilities in India, Pakistan, Egypt, off Malaysia, and Mexico. Are you in competition with other firms around the world looking to deeper and deeper sources of oil?
Yeah, it's a heavily competitive field, and the deepwater Gulf of Mexico is only a part of the story globally. There's deep water deposits around the world in many of the countries that you just listed.
You've said you'd be more comfortable seeing this well, the Jack well, perform for a year or so before going full steam ahead here. What still needs to be proved? What are the issues at that site?
Well, because the rocks are of less porosity and less permeability, and they're obscured by a thick layer of salt, it's difficult with even the extended well tests that we have to have full confidence that the field will ultimately perform at a rate that would be economic. So we produced it for about a month. That's a very long extended flow test. It gives us a lot of confidence, but I guess you'd always have, there's always room to have more.
Oil is under $60 a barrel today for the first time in many months. How low can it go and still have wells like this profitable?
Well, that's a key point, is the deep water around the world, but particularly with this play, is a very high-cost play. So we have to have prices that would be somewhat higher to support it economically. I hesitate to give you a firm number, but in the $30 to $40 range, as long as prices stay north of that, we can make this economic.
And given this extreme drilling, let me just ask you, you're an oil man, how do you feel, or how would you feel about the world one day being dependent for a significant portion of its oil on undersea wells 5, 6, 7, maybe more miles down? Is this such extreme drilling that that's a risky source of oil, or not in your view?
I would say it's risky from the standpoint that there are a lot of new technologies that have to be proven up. But I think it's going to be a secure source of oil, and that's going to be important for the United States. It's good to have oil that's in our backyard, so to speak.
Paul Sigley, Vice President of Chevron's Deepwater Gulf Exploration and Projects. Mr. Sigley, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to turn now to New York City and Roger Anderson. He's a renowned expert in energy, oil drilling, technology there, senior scholar at the Center for Computational Learning Systems and Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University, professor of earth and environmental sciences there. Roger Anderson, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Now, we know this technology has been bubbling up for some years now. It's new to most of the world since this Jack II find. Just how big a deal is it that we're now drilling and pulling up oil from these depths?
Well, it's a very big deal. Globally, there's deep. This is like the last frontier, this what I call the ultra-deep water. The only thing deeper than that is the basalt and lava from the ocean crust, and you cannot get any oil out of that. So this is like the last great frontier in terms of water depths. There's not much else out there besides this. So conquering it is a big last frontier.
Give us a sense of the layered challenges in going after oil this deep under the sea. What have the big challenges been technically?
Well, technically, the first layer is finding it in the first place. So you have to have seismic technology that has quite a new generation of resolution. Particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, it's covered by a surface sheet of salt called the Salt Sigsbee. Salt sheet, and salt is very light density and hard to see through, so they've had to do a lot of an invention to be able to see the oil reservoirs in the first place.
Describe those reservoirs for us. Paul Sigley was saying these are older and deeper than what's been tapped before. What era does this oil come from?
Well, this is the most exciting part about it, actually, to me. That it's much more attuned to the gigantic oil fields in Mexico than it is to the shelf and southern Louisiana, Texas salt dome province that we're all familiar with in America. That's all Gulf of Mexico delta from the Mississippi River. These new reserves in this 50, 60, 70, 80 million year old rock are much older than that, and also can be carbonates, which can hold very large volumes of oil. Compared to delta sands, which are prolific but don't last as long. So one of the big questions when they start producing it is how fast will the decline curve be for how it dissipates.
And what about the quality of oil they're pulling up from this enormous depth and age?
Well, they say that it's very good quality oil. Quality is a funny word for crude. It really depends on what kind of refineries you have. We're doing just fine with bad quality oil from Saudi Arabia and Venezuela if you build a refinery that can take the bad stuff out. Now, that bad stuff is bad. It's things like sulfur and big contaminants. So it being light and sweet, as we call it, means that it's better for the environmental impact that it's going to have to refine it.
Now, we're talking about rigs being rented for $500,000 a day to go after oil like this. Tremendous water pressures down there. Maybe 1 million pounds of pipe, I'm reading here, stacked up in these miles-long sort of chains of pipe that get down to the oil. Does it look like this is going to be economical for the oil industry?
Well, of course, getting that discovery well in place is the least of the problems. The biggest problem is getting it to shore economically and in large volumes so that you can make enough money to pay for all of that early investment. Remember, you're buying the car before you ever start building the car, so it better pay off. And that, of course, depends on water depth. If there's gas mixed in, and there always is with oil, the gas freezes in pipelines. And so if you're going to lay pipelines on the seafloor to get it to shore, you have to put antifreeze in the pipes, which becomes very expensive.
So we're talking about laying pipelines at some of the deepest ocean depths on the planet.
That's right, and as you might have noticed about a month ago in some seismically active areas and certainly gigantically hurricane-active areas.
Does it look like a secure source of oil to you, Professor?
Oh, absolutely, yes, because most of the security statement is not geological, it's political. You're going to be talking about peak oil later on. Peak mm-hmm. oil is not just a geologic problem, it's a political problem.
Professor, let me ask you about how deep we might ultimately go. I mean, they're talking 7 miles here now, 8, 9, 10. How deep does oil go on this planet?
Well, not that deep. This is about the last frontier in terms of water depth. There's nothing out there beyond that than the kinds of lava that you see in Hawaii. So this is about the last frontier.
And those big ships, like Paul Sigley was describing, that hover above these wells, this is not the old sort of pillars to the floor of the sea model. This is ships with very sophisticated, lots of engines and propellers keeping them steady over that drill point. That must be quite a challenge in itself.
It is, and they do a wonderful job of it, but the big challenge is, and the innovation is that they produce it after they've discovered it with equipment that actually sits on the seafloor those 5 miles down. And that's been a problem, getting it to make sure that it doesn't leak and that it will last for the 20 to 30 to 40 years that each of these oil fields is going to last.
We've heard a lot about stronger hurricanes in recent years. Is that an issue here long term over that many decades? If we've got lots of these wells pumping from so deep and ships that have to stay right in place, or, I don't know, big swells and hurricanes an issue?
Well, you could envisage a future out here in this deep water where there was nothing at the sea floor surface at all. There have even been designs where the production platform would sink below the waves when the hurricanes come. Nobody's ever actually built that yet. But the hurricanes are not going to bother the production equipment that's 5 miles 5 miles down. It's the connection to shore. Somewhere along the line, it's got to come to the surface, and that's what got us badly in Katrina.
And down and down and down we go to the last frontier of deep water oil. Roger Anderson in New York City, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I want to turn now to Matthew Simmons. He joins us from Rockport, Maine. He's chairman of Simmons & Company International, specialized in energy investment. He's author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. He's been a leading proponent of the peak oil theory. That's the one that says we're past the peak and we may be in trouble. Matthew Simmons, thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure to be with you.
And with us from Amherst, Massachusetts, Michael Lynch, president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research, Inc. He was formerly director of Asian Energy and Security at the Center for International Studies at MIT. He's been looking at computer models of the world oil market and says there may be more than we think. Michael Lynch, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you, Tom.
Matthew Simmons, first to you. You've been arguing that we've got a peak oil problem. Describe that for us as you see it, and how does deep water oil factor in?
Well, first of all, I want to say it's phenomenal. We basically are still discovering some new trends that have never seen a drill bit. But I have to say that I was astonished at the at the way that too many analysts took the information that I think was very carefully delivered by Chevron a couple of weeks ago. And by the end of the day, there were reports all around saying that the Jack field was possibly as big as Prudhoe Bay.
Mm-hmm.
What Chevron said is that basically if everything works out, and they have very scanty information so far, and it might well take them years to get enough information to have the courage to commercially figure out how to do what would probably be a $2 or $3 billion project.
And we quoted Paul Sigley saying that he'd like to see it running for another year before his confidence is fully up to snuff.
That one well running for another year before they know where to drill in more wells. So the information they have on Jack is scanty at best. Where the Prudhoe Bay numbers come from is assuming that Jack fields are scattered all over a 200 to 300 mile trend.
So how do you see us sitting globally in relation to peak oil, and does deep water oil make a difference or not?
Well, the problem is we're out of deep water rigs. Every deep water rig in the world is working. There are about 12 deep water rigs that are now on order being built, but the earliest ones will start arriving in late 2007 if they come on time. The majority of them are late 2008, 2009 if they're on time. The last time we had a big deep water drilling boom, the average rig took 2 years more than it was planned to build and cost almost double. So,
does that time frame really matter in the terms we're talking about? I mean, you can't make more oil, but you can build more rigs. Are we really that close to oil shortages that 2 or 3, 4 years make a difference?
Well, the problem is that it will effectively take the better part of a decade to really drill enough wells in the lower tertiary in the Gulf of Mexico to have some idea as to whether this could be collectively 40 or 50 fields that could add up to a Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay added 1.5 million barrels a day to the U.S. and global oil supply. If we have to wait a decade before we get that, and we have decline rates in areas like the North Sea that are basically 300,000 or 400,000 barrels a day a year, then whatever we find is just going to offset a rapidly rising decline rate.
Michael Lynch, how are you interpreting this news? We've got the Gulf of Mexico and then the South China Sea and coasts off the coast of India, Pakistan, Mauritania, Egypt, Malaysia, Mexico. There's a lot being written about this. Do you see this as putting peak oil off? Is it still in our sights? How do you understand deep water oil's implication here?
Well, I agree with Matt that this one particular find was overhyped, misinterpreted by analysts. But, you know, this is an example of what the resource pessimists have run into over the last 15 decades, which is that, fields run down and regions run down, and we keep finding more. And what's happening is that this is basically just now entering, shall we say, the project pipeline. And it won't appear, as Matt says, for, 8-10 years, and it won't be significant for 12 or 15. But in the meantime, there's other things coming online, and this will be something that, in 10 or 12 years will start showing up and will have an impact then.
So in terms of where the world stands in relationship to peak oil, the point at which supplies really start to fundamentally to diminish, do you see deep water oil as extending that, Michael Lynch?
Yes, I do. And I've been making the argument for many years that the peak keeps being extended. We keep being told the peak is a year or two out. The leader of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, Colin Campbell, has been predicting the peak since 1989 when he said that year was the peak. And I think now he's out to 2010. So there'll be more things coming online further on in the future.
More things. We heard Roger Anderson say this is the final frontier as far as deep oil drilling goes. I mean, this is as deep as you're going to find it practically where they're playing now.
Well, it's in that sense, yes, but in the sense of finding other basins that are not in the deep water, finding them, for instance, in Central Africa, where right now people don't drill because of the lack of infrastructure. The Sudan has just come online in the last few years. It's going to add a lot of oil this year, and it's a fairly small play. So there's lots of different places and ways and types in terms of to add oil. In terms of deep water, yeah, we're not going to go much deeper than this, obviously, but there are other ways to extend the resource base.
Matthew Simmons, there's the resource pessimist line thrown out, but you're saying this is just a blip. We're still, where are we in your view? At peak oil? Beyond it already?
Well, there's an interesting table that the Department of Energy publishes in their monthly energy supply that has been basically sort of out in public domain now for the last several months. It shows that in December 2005, global crude oil production, this excludes natural gas liquids, was close to 75 million barrels a day, an all-time record. And it declined every month thereafter, and the last data we have from the August report is in May, and we're already off almost a million barrels a day.
But crude oil price down below $60 for the first time in 6 months as of today. Where's the crunch here if we're in it?
The crude oil price is so fluctuates so violently that it is really basically a very misleading guide as to whether we have a problem or don't have a problem.
So the price is not the indicator. That leaves us with what? Just a sort of statistical geologist understanding?
It leaves us sort of in the dark because we have weekly reports of the petroleum stocks in the United States that are very hazy, only limited samples that we gross up, and most people then think that's a perfect proxy for the oil supplies around the world. And all we know, basically, is the market is as tight as it's ever been, and we theoretically have some million and a half, 2 million barrels a day of spare capacity. But what I find interesting is that there's no one on earth that can actually pinpoint exactly where the spare capacity is going to come from.
So when does the trouble hit your fan, hit the fan in your view, Matthewson?
Well, when supply basically falls behind demand and we liquidate enough inventories that we have nothing left to liquidate of usable inventories, and then we have a shortage.
Is there a place on the calendar you can point to and say that's when it's coming?
No, but I think we basically, I think we were lucky in the summer to get by without any shortages. I think we're going to be lucky this winter. If we have a cold winter, we're going to have the same worries that Europe did. I think natural gas poses probably realistically a more serious problem than oil. So I hope the optimists are right, because if they are, then it's going to spare us an awful lot of work. But I also think that the problem is so serious that people ought to take it seriously and prepare for some sort of a game plan, some sort of insurance policy, so that if the pessimists are right, it won't be a showstopper.
We're talking about peak oil and deep water oil. Paul's calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've read is that as with global warming, the ice in the Arctic Sea has been melting to a certain extent, and there's the prospect of drilling for oil in the Arctic Ocean, which to me seems a little ironic. You know, we're warming up the planet enough to suck the
melt the ice cap so we can get at that oil and melt it some more.
Yeah, exactly. So I was wondering if these technologies are related in any way, drilling in the Arctic Sea and drilling in these very deep wells.
Michael Lynch, can you see us chasing our tail there? Melt the ice caps, bring on the rigs, and drill the poles.
I don't think so. I mean, he raises a good point, but I think the industry has so many other targets right now that it would rather pursue that going up to the Arctic, worrying about who owns what particular spot of land and whether or not the ice is going to come back again. I mean, there is some cyclical element in the melting and a lot of uncertainty. So I think the industry would rather, go to places like the Gulf of Mexico and worry about the hurricanes.
They'd rather. Rebecca's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
What I was wondering was, let's say we look into the future and we have these pipes laid out across the ocean. They've been drilling pipe, oil's being transferred to, who knows where.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you have an earthquake on the bottom of the ocean floor? Where does this oil go and how do you clean that up? I imagine it would go everywhere.
It's a great question, Matthew Simmons. I mean, we've seen the maps already of the pipelines along the Gulf of Mexico floor. They're all over the place. Is it a different kettle of fish if it's deep water drilling? And what about if there's a big earthquake down there?
One of the shocking pieces of news post Katrina and Rita, and I can't remember now whether it was Rita that did this or Katrina that did it, is that about 7 months later, when they finally got enough subsurface equipment to do some very accurate camera work, there was one pipeline that was basically slightly below the earth bed and totally anchored down, that had moved almost a mile.
Wow.
During the hurricane.
Wow. Would they perhaps be safer at a deep water level then? If they're a mile down, is that less likely, or are they more likely to be disrupted?
Well, see, the other funny thing you have in deep water is an element called flow currents. And flow currents are apparently like hitting a typhoon. And it's interesting to watch. For instance, there are a couple of very key tests that were supposed to be drilled this summer that they've postponed because they think that's probably the worst of the flow currents. There is so much that we basically don't know yet about the conditions at these water depths. And what's also interesting is the technology that is around now to develop it was carefully developed over two decades. So another piece of the hype after post-Jack was that somehow we suddenly developed a whole score of new technologies that didn't exist before. The reality is, that we were beginning to drill wells that were at 10,000 feet water depths 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, we've seen it. It's just come to public awareness with this coming on stream. Michael Lynch, what do you think about a deep water rupture? Let's say there's seismic action down there. Is it different at deep water than nearer to the surface? Is the impact of a spill the same? Does the oil rise to the surface? What happens?
Well, heavy oil, I mean, if it was really heavy, it would tend to sink, but the lighter oil would rise. The biggest danger is that, you know, eventually the pipeline comes into shallow water areas. So, you know, you're never completely safe in that sense. But the industry tries to cope with that. It has been fairly successful to date. We did have certainly a lot of leakage after Katrina, as Matt mentioned. But, you know, the refineries on shore and the storage tanks also were a problem. And frankly, you know, you get a lot of oil seeping out from natural seeps, which people tend to forget.
But let's say that deep water oil does become a significant portion of the world supply. Are you worried, Michael Lynch, about the security of that supply, just given the extreme location of it? And, the, you know, I'm reading about 1 million pounds of pipe required to pull it up in the Jack II well.
I'm a little bit concerned. I think I'm a little more concerned about pipelines that go through 3 or 4 countries in the Caspian area. Or, you know, Iraqi oil. I think that's where, you know, the biggest oil spill we've had recently was when Israel bombed a power plant in Lebanon and all the tanks spilled out on the beach. So, you know, we've been vulnerable for about a century since oil was coming out of the Baku. And I don't see that changing significantly, whether you use this deep water oil or not.
As big as the risks may be down there, we make bigger ones right on the surface. Jim is calling from District Heights, Maryland. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm wondering why we don't focus more on eliminating that extra step of digging for oil when we could be better served by drilling holes in the earth and extracting heat instead of oil. We can take that heat, create steam, make electricity, crack water into hydrogen and oxygen. We've got a clean fuel. We end the need for foreign oil. And oil altogether.
It's a great question. Matthew Simmons, what about it? If we're going to go down 6, 7, 8 miles, why not drill for heat instead of crude?
Well, I'm a very avid proponent of stepping up our R&D for some of the things that we barely know anything about creating energy. And water turns out to be my number one favorite topic. And there's no question that it would appear that you can drill holes into the earth virtually any place in the world, and the further that you go down, the hotter it gets. And there's a phenomenal way to turn seawater into steam. But again, are we working on it today? No, not really. Would it be easy to do? No, not really. Is it technically possible? Absolutely.
And the billions that go into deep water drilling, could they make a difference?
Well, first of all, I think we have to do both. I think we have to go on an enormous expansion program of our drilling fleet, or we won't drill holes into the earth for either steam or for oil. I think we have a people crisis on our doorstep that's going to be just an unbelievably hard thing to get over, and will take at least a decade.
Right now, joining us from Boston is Robert Kaufman, director at Boston University's Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. He's looking hard at peak oil, putting together a big conference this fall on it. Robert Kaufman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
So here we've got the whole world's attention when peak oil comes up and scares the heck out of us and thinks that oil may go away and we've got to get alternative energies, and environmentalists feeling, you know, some relief that the very shortages may encourage alternative energy that helps forestall global warming. If we get deep water oil coming on stream, does that pull the plug on the very, alternate strategies that might help the environment?
I guess I would be a little worried about what's coming next. I know a lot of environmentalists are all enthused about the next fuel being much cleaner, but having attended a lot of meetings both from the government and private sector, a lot of people are talking about gasifying coal and using traditional fossil fuels to replace oil, and if that's the case, you kind of want oil to last as long as possible because the alternatives are worse.
You mean tar sands and coal, and I don't know if you put nuclear in that worst category or not?
Well, nuclear couldn't really run our automobile fleet or our airplanes, and that's really where oil is most important. So things like tar sands, oil shales, coal gasification all emit a lot more carbon than crude oil.
Let's take a call from Elkin, North Carolina. Donald's on the line. Hi, Donald. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
I've been in Texas and Oklahoma, and I've seen oil wells out there not being used. For example, I know several people who are being paid not to pump oil. Now, why don't they use these oil wells and forget about this deep water until we're actually shortage on oil, the crude?
Why are we going to the ends of the earth if they're not pumping everything they've got in Texas and Oklahoma? I don't know. Matthew Simmons, what do you say to that?
Well, that's a surprise to me. I think basically the, you know, any significant oil and gas that we have in Oklahoma and Texas is being pumped every single day. Now, you could it could be in an area that the amount of brine that's coming out of the wells is so much higher than the oil that you still don't have some sort of a commercial payback. But if an oil well is commercial in the United States or a gas well, it's being pumped today. There isn't any sort of collusion of artificially shutting stuff in.
Donald, thanks for your call. Let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut, and Peter. Peter, you're on the air. Hello, Peter, are you there, my friend?
I'm right here.
What do you know?
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
I wanted to know, with all the talk about getting all this crude oil, do you guys think somewhere in the future that we'll be getting cleaner systems to run our cars so that it would prevent all this global warming? What do you guys predict that this will all happen?
Peter, thanks for your call. Robert Coffin, let me put that to you. You know, over the summer, there was a bipartisan group of senators, minority, introduced legislation looking to raise vehicle fuel economy standards to 35 miles a gallon in the USA by 2017. That would save 2.5 million barrels of oil a day by 2025. That's more than the biggest estimates of what might come out of this new find in the Gulf of Mexico. And that didn't pass. So if we get more oil coming on, will there be even less pressure for you know, cutting carbon use?
You know, it's either you kind of pay me now or you pay me later. Eventually, I think everybody on the show would agree that eventually we're going to have to find some alternative to oil. The timing may be uncertain. And so it's just a matter of when are we going to do it?
Michael Lynch, do you see the deep water discoveries changing the calendar, changing that date, pushing out alternative energies to a more distant arrival point?
Well, I think so. I remember reading in one of the auto magazines, the editor said, when I first started out, people said the electric car was just around the corner, and now they're saying it's still just around the corner. You know, you've got to remember, wind and solar are growing rapidly right now. They have areas where they're economical, and they're they're progressing quite rapidly, and I think you'll continue to see that. But I think 20, 30 years from now, we'll find that the transportation system is still largely oil-based.
Matthew Simmons, there's a strange sort of response that the country has here. On the one hand, gasoline was so high recently, heating oil bills have been high. When people hear about more energy coming on stream, there's a feeling of relief. At the same time, even President Bush says we are addicted to oil and need to get out of it. You've put the peak oil threat right out there and seen the pace of alternative energy response. Do you think deep water, our sense of what might be out there, changes that calendar? Do we get deeper in environmental trouble if people think there's more under the sea?
Well, I think the biggest risk we face is that the euphoria of some discoveries that really won't have any impact of any significance on the global scene for a decade, starts talking down oil prices that then start eliminating some of the R&D being done to start beginning to prepare for a world beyond sustainable peak oil supply. In my book, if we get out a year from now and we see that December 2005 record still there and we're down by 1.5 million barrels a day, then I think we can safely say we actually saw peak oil at the end of 2005.
So you think we're past it? Already.
I think on a sustained basis, we're so close to being past it, we shouldn't be arguing a date. We should be basically all rolling up our sleeves and saying, what are the things we can do in a 5 to 7 year period of time, and throw out the window all of the 20, 25, 30-year things, because they basically, work on them, but they're too far in the future to have a solution that will impact our lives or our children's lives.
Michael Lynch, here's the place where all of us onlookers get confused. I mean, we're reading, I'm quoting Robert Esser here at the Cambridge Energy Research Associates, saying peak oil theory is garbage as far as we're concerned. Matthew Simmons says we're already in deep trouble and we need to get onto alternate energies, deep oil, be damned, just as quick as we can.
Well, we've been told actually that the peak is here for quite some time. I remember quite a number of analysts arguing that December 2000 was the peak. And it turned out it was really just a seasonal peak, and production has gone up. James Schlesinger, the Secretary of Energy, who thinks we're near the peak now, thought we were at the peak in 1979. There's a lot of resource base out there. The problem is much more equipment and people, which I know Matt would agree on that. But I think that this is basically just a misreading of the data. And we're going to find, just as Malthus turned out to be wrong a couple hundred years ago, that the models are not always very good representations of reality.
Robert Kaufman, I mean, in that and what you've described, I'm sure at least people wondering, what the heck do we do here? You've said you'd rather have oil, this kind of oil, than some of its dirty alternatives, cranking up coal and tar sands. So when does alternative energy come to the rescue here? We've got a global warming process on, scientists tell us, every day. And you're saying, well, we still need oil.
Well, we still need oil, but, we can argue about when the peak's going to come. And really, what's beyond argument is that there's only so much carbon dioxide this atmosphere can hold. The concentration is rising, temperature is rising, and in many ways that may prove to be a limit well before we run out of oil or peak oil occurs. And I would argue that we need to start right now very seriously addressing what's coming next, whether it's oil, whether we remain with oil or go to something dirtier. Most of the alternatives being currently proposed and worked on are really not going to solve this ultimate problem, and that is the atmosphere can't take much more carbon dioxide.
It's pretty amazing, pouring billions into going to the absolute extremes of the planet to get the oil and still not full pedal to the metal on the alternate front. Rob's calling from Santa Rosa, Florida. Hi, Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're good. What do you see, Rob?
Well, my question mainly is that, the caller you had before made a point of why we don't have a cleaner source of fuel, and all this money that's being spent on researching how to get oil from the depths of the ocean, that it's not a renewable resource. Can't we spend money trying to find a cleaner burning renewable resource? All these oil companies could maybe transition to that, because, ultimately it is our environment at stake here. And, without, global warming and all, I live on the Gulf of Mexico, and I see the impact of the hurricanes, every year.
Yeah, we know you have. Matthew Simmons, how about it? What would it take to get some more of these billions turned away from the ocean floor and toward faster development of alternatives?
Well, we're doing a lot more today than we were doing a decade ago. Out in Golden, Colorado, the Department of Energy have a very impressive renewable energy laboratory and 1,200 dedicated people working hard for both solar and wind and biofuels. In the biofuel area, there's an awful lot we need to do about turning, stop using corn kernels and using the stalks and in the cellulosity mm-hmm. issue. But we're just barely getting started on this research, and we can't shut down deep water and turn the research to there, because there's only so much money you can pour at it. But I think if we don't basically start to do every possible thing to stabilize supply while we work on some very creative programs mm-hmm. to start reducing the amount of energy that we use for transportation and finding some substitutes of heat, we're going to be in very deep water, no pun intended.
Let me take a call from New Haven, Connecticut. Deborah is on the line. Hi, Deborah, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to say, back in the 70s, I actually worked for an oil company, BP, that's now owned by BP.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had the other so-called oil shortage, which we found out it wasn't, and they had the ridiculous windfall profits, I'm going to tell you what the oil companies did. They gave people huge bonuses, extra checks. I got stock, depending on how much I made. There was no oil shortage, and
you're talking about the 1970s when OPEC put the brakes on, and
absolutely.
We saw the lines around the block for gas.
Yes, absolutely. There was plenty of oil. There was an oil stoppage. Okay, so if you want to say that created a shortage, that's fine. But the fact is, even during that time, oil companies made huge windfall profits.
So, what are you suggesting here?
What I'm suggesting is that the lowering of the prices right now and this miraculous discovery is all political, and that right after the elections, if the Republican majority maintains control of the House and the Senate and the White House, the profits, the oil prices will go back up. because there will be no one to keep them in check. It's just that simple.
There's a big skeptical view of it, and I have to say I've looked at the polls, and a lot of Americans share that view that somehow oil prices are being whittled down on a political agenda. Michael Lynch, is that possible?
Well, I haven't seen anything done by the Bush administration that would have brought them down lately. It's all been a question of market forces. And, you know, then you'd have to say, well, why did they push them up in the first place? Or why did they have them high in 2004? Why didn't we invade Iraq and lose all that oil there? The problem with conspiracy theories is there's usually a lot more theory than reality behind them.
Matthew Simmons, how about it? A lot of Americans do suspect that that might happen. Is it possible, or is it beyond what can be conspired around, in your view?
You know, having watched daily the sort of chatter that goes on in energy publications. Mm-hmm. About the current price of oil and why the price of oil is where it is it made this astonishing march from $10 in the spring of 1999 to almost $80 about 6 weeks ago. It's amazing. It's always something that's basically causing the rise, and it's rarely something called market fundamentals tightness. It's the hedge funds one day. It's the Jack discovery the next day. We have also had so many violent collapses as oil prices have risen almost eightfold.
Of governments, political instability, you're saying?
It's a commodity that we're now pricing entirely in the commodity pits. We've created volatility that shouldn't be there. I think there's actually some fairly serious discussion now going on by people like Senator Lugar that are arguing that maybe it's time to put a floor under oil and gas prices so we create some confidence to start working on some alternatives. And frankly, I think that sort of dialogue makes a lot of sense.
But you don't see this as something that can be manipulated, this crude price?
No, it's the world's largest natural resource.
Robert Kaufman?
Yeah, I would argue there are some market fundamentals under this rise from the end of the Asian crisis to now, and they have to do with the amount of stocks being held commercially. They have to do with the amount of spare capacity on the planet. And so I just, like the others, I don't see any real concerted conspiracy. There's a lot of fear that goes into the market, but there are market forces behind the rise and market forces behind the recent decline.
Let's turn to San Diego, California, and John. Hi, John, you're on the air.
The point I'd like to make is that even though we find new deposits of oil, we cannot afford to relax our efforts on alternative energy. Our consistent effort must maintain that way, and even increase even further. But the point is that, you know, hey, we got new oil, but we can't afford to relax our efforts. Thank you very much.
Don't get comfortable. Thanks to you, John. And one more from Louisville, Kentucky. Jonathan is on the line. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to say I've been following peak oil for about a year, and I think that it's going to happen, and we could already be there. And, Mr. Simmons, I've been following your work, too, and I really appreciate it. And I just think that the longer that we put it off, the more that we're just looking for more oil, the worse the crash is going to be when we start to decline.
So watch out there on the ocean floor. That may not solve it in your view. Jonathan, thanks for your call. Michael Lynch, so where does this all leave us? Precarious in terms of energy supply in the environment? Better off because oil's been found deeper on the ocean floor?
Well, I think we're generally better off, and not just the deep water oil finds, but what we see around the world. I think there are a lot of people around the world who would be much better off burning oil than creating deforestation. There are definitely environmental challenges. I'm concerned about the ability of the atmosphere to hold carbon. But I think all we've seen in the past couple of years is just a typical cycle, a commodity cycle, which has been exacerbated by political problems like the Iraq War. And people are rushing to interpret that as a long-term change. And we've seen this before. And in a couple of years, this will all be forgotten.
Maybe you're right. Maybe we're past the peak. Maybe it gets better. Maybe it gets worse. But it's coming up from very deep these days, miles and miles beneath the surface of the sea. It's just kind of an incredible image. I want to thank each of you for being with us in this hour. Michael Lynch at Strategic Energy and Economic Research, Inc., joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Matthew Simmons, chairman of Simmons & Company International, author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. Matthew Simmons, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome. Good program.
Thank you. And Robert Kaufman, director at Boston University's Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. Professor Kaufman, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.